scrolling for 2/22/22. It's Tuesday. I'm Steve Fodor.
I'm Chip Hassenflaw.
And I'm Pam Vidor.
Hey, Pam's here making our 2 a 3.
A threesome.
A threesome? Are you from the south suburbs now? Have you been in North Carolina so long? Hey, it's a threesome over by there.
Steve, that's because I'm in Chicago today, baby.
Hey, Chip's in studio. Pam is not. Pam is still on the TV screen, but it's great to see you, Pam. How you doing?
I'm doing great. Great to see you guys.
And Chip, how's life in North Carolina? Is it warm?
Steve,
do you remember? Do you remember North Carolina?
I remember walking last Saturday and it was 70 degrees out there, walking through the forest preserve, and Chicago right now was like 4 degrees. Mm-hmm. So let's just say it's a blast being here.
It's different. It's a blast of cold air.
Film at 11.
Brings you to our film at 11, our movie of the week. Hey, Chip, have you gone to a movie theater this week?
I haven't, Steve. I've been locked in on the Olympics. They are the most fascinating of all Olympics ever.
The Winter Olympics is happening on TV right now.
Steve, people push rocks down and they have brooms.
There's ice and rocks.
I think the guy's name was Shemp.
No, that's, it's not curly, it's curling. You misunderstood. Yeah, wise guy.
Steve, but that gives you plenty of opportunities to go out and to find some streaming service, to find something to watch. What did you watch this week, Steve?
So right before the Super Bowl on Sunday.
Was there a wrap?
We did make wraps. They were delicious. Right before the Super Bowl on Sunday, my family and I sat around and we watched the new Peacock series, Bel Air. This is the dramatic, very dark telling of the Will Smith story, The Fresh Prince of Bel Air.
So are you telling me the Super Bowl, which was on NBC, mm-hmm. which owns Peacock, mm-hmm. and during the halftime of the Super Bowl, they had all, you know, Snoop Dogg, Dr. Dre, Eminem, but no Will Smith, Steve? Why would Will Smith not be in the rap?
Because that was all a L.A. thing. There was all L.A. and Eminem.
That's right. And 8 Mile.
And 8 Mile. From L.A. L.A.'s 8 Mile.
But nothing from Philadelphia moving to L.A. or Beverly Hills?
No, they excluded people from that performance. We had such a great time watching that halftime. That halftime was a big hit in our household, I'll tell you that.
There was a lot of dancing going on, Steve.
There was a lot of dancing in our house.
But Steve, that brings us to The Fresh Prince.
Yeah, this version of Bel Air, not The Fresh Prince, is definitely a different style of storytelling. This is very dark, very dramatic. There are big stakes in this storytelling. That whole story about I got in one little fight and my mom got scared is amplified to a murderous level in this show. The Will Smith character has his life threatened. He is the one that sort of instigates this fight.
Is this a period piece from that time, or is this a modern, a sort of reinterpretation of that story?
This is 21st century modernization of that story, for sure. Okay. The violence that is something that the Will Smith character is afraid of is something that isn't new, but the amplification of it in this story is very 21st century. The fact that there are guns involved in the storytelling is very much a different way of looking at it from the 90s perspective.
And obviously, he started out in Philadelphia, mm-hmm. and moved to California. But obviously, I mean, you can think of like kids growing up in downtown Chicago.
For sure. Yeah. Or in
any of the dangerous neighborhoods you could think of.
Yeah, this is a mirror of our real existence with those zones where kids have real concerns about their safety.
Is this an ongoing series or mm-hmm. a period of time? Is this like an eight episode series.
This is a 10 episode series, okay, ongoing every week. We have gotten through 4 weeks of this program so far, and we are ready for more of this storytelling. We have the same characters from the original sitcom, but they are certainly different from the 1990s silly sitcom. They are definitely 21st century. Hillary, for instance, is not only a fashionista like she was in the original, but she's also an influencer. She is trying to find her way through the social media influencers set in Bel Air, and she's given a job that she does not accept because they want her to change who she is in order to do this job.
Is the son like a TikTok dancer?
He is not. He's quite possibly the darkest character in the story. Oh. Carlton has a chip on his shoulder in this, and he does not like the fact that Will Smith is a part of his family and taking over some of his territory at high school.
And he didn't realize that later on he'll be hosting America's Funniest Home Video.
He's just adorable. This story is a lot more like another show that's on right now called All American, mm-hmm, where a young man is given the opportunity to be a part of a basketball system that is, you know, the best in the state, and how that interaction with those characters, that family that he's living with, changes who he is. I like this very much.
So what we need is something even on a brighter tone. Pam, tell us all about, you know, 2014's The Giver.
Well, I'm really interested to see Bel Air now that you've said that, Steve. Thanks for that. So my eighth grader just read The Giver for school, which is a young adult dystopian novel that I think I read at that age, and I reread maybe 5 years ago, and I found it really interesting. So since they were super excited about the novel, I thought, oh, I'm going to watch this movie, which I've been meaning to read, and it wasn't very good. So it was interesting because I actually thought the actors were great and the set was amazing, mm-hmm, but they changed the story in ways that made no sense to me. But really, like, the setting was so cool. They really pulled out what that dystopian society might look like beautifully. And Meryl Streep was in it. But they just, sometimes you get those novels with like really perfectly plotted novels, and I would put The Giver in that category. Mm-hmm. And then why would you ever change that story? I couldn't figure it out.
I felt the same way about Ender's Game, Ender's Game. That's such a perfect story. That narrative gives so much, and they took out so much of that narrative for the beautiful set, beautiful costumes. Yes. It is a visual feast without the meat of that original story.
Like Star Wars.
Or Dune.
Ooh, which you guys don't spoil it. No. My book club is reading Dune next month, and I'm gonna watch the movie between then and now. So lots you didn't think it was very good.
It's beautiful. It is it is fascinating to look at, but the narrative doesn't have the same teeth to it.
Right. And why? Why? When you have such a good story, why would you change
it? It's a different format. Ah! It's just a different format. That's how it goes.
Well, yes. You know, the great part about it is we have a lot of great movies coming up this week that we should probably introduce, Steve.
Well, I don't know that you're very positive today, Chip. Let's go through these movies. The first one is the wide release of the movie Cyrano. This is Peter Dinklage taking the part of Cyrano de Bergerac. I really want to see this movie. This came out at the end of the year and is open for Oscars. And now it'll be open for everybody else to watch.
Well, and this is like where he takes the words of Sting and the Police and they sing about Roxanne.
You don't have to put on the 48 hours. Is this Eddie Murphy? Yes. I look forward to this one.
All right. And Steve, that leaves us Andy Garcia's next great film.
Yeah. Remember Andy Garcia, everyone? He's got a movie this week. It's called Big Gold Brick. This is the story of a fledgling writer who has this crazy experience with a very strange, different person here.
Well, Steve, this doesn't look like it's saving me, but thank goodness Bruce Willis is coming up.
Bruce Willis is here to save you. Don't worry. Don't worry, everyone. Bruce Willis is here. The next great Bruce Willis film is called Gasoline Alley. This is a man implicated in the triple homicide of three Hollywood starlets and features Bruce Willis, Devon Sawa, and Luke Wilson.
Well, that sounds great, but it's not based on the comic strip that went forever.
No,
I mean,
no, not that Gasoline Alley. So, I hope.
So, Steve, let's get to the next one to see if that helps us.
The Desperate Hour. This is, wow. This is, I'm surprised that this is coming out in February. This seems to me like one of the best acting that I've seen in a trailer for a while. This is Naomi Watts.
She's a jogger.
She is out for a jog. She's 5 miles away from her home, and her whole town gets locked down, and we see her desperation trying to get back home. It is called The Desperate Hour because it is a real-time 1 hour of desperation.
And 5 miles.
At 5 miles.
So, you know, maybe if you're working out, you can get the 5 miles in as you're watching this.
This is
Steve, and that's so you can get back. And if you're going to do some cooking, what type of cooking oil would you like?
That's a terrible segue. The next movie is called Butter.
And it's, it looks like a terrible movie.
It looks like a terrible movie.
It's about a big man.
Yeah, a 400-pound young man.
On campus.
Big man on campus. 400-pound young man who is suffering from all sorts of problems at school and decides that he's going to commit suicide by eating. This sounds like a terrible premise.
And it's about bullying in a way, and about how sort of embracing, just basically just going for it, living your life, sort of makes people like you.
Yeah.
And then you eat butter. So, Steve, let's go with something that maybe is like a music group trying to put together a movie.
Yeah, this happens every once in a while, right? Music groups decide that they want to be movie stars. And the Foo Fighters are the next group up. This movie called Studio 666. It is written by Dave Grohl of the Foo Fighters. It is the story of the Foo Fighters moving into a mansion that's haunted.
And they're going to record their next album, which I bet there's an album coming out, Steve. I'm just going to throw that out there. There's new Foo Fighter music on the way.
Yeah, this features Whitney Cummings, Jeff Garlin, Will Forte, and mostly the Foo Fighters.
Well, it looks great.
It doesn't look great, but it's certainly going to be entertaining.
Fun. Of all the movies this week, this one looks fun.
It looks like fun for sure.
Book it. Book it.
Brings us to our book it, our book of the week. The reason Pam is here is our monthly book club is still here after all of this time. It's been what, like 18, 19 years since we've been doing COVID? I don't even know how long it's been, Pam.
Steve, my beard is almost touching the ground at this point.
You shaved your beard after the new year.
Steve, don't tell everybody that.
This growing. Is a podcast. He can have any beard he wants.
Exactly. By the end of the year, I am Father Time. And right now, it's just growing.
That's the new year. That's how you do it.
I'm a baby new year.
So this month, we chose a nonfiction book. This one is called How Civil Wars Start and How to Stop Them. This is a very recent release written by Barbara F. Walter.
She's a professor at the University of California, San Diego, and her expertise is working with our federal government, military too, and also to review other countries for the chances and putting together models for their chances that they will break out into civil war. Interestingly enough, they turned those same models on the United States. And we have a book.
Mm-hmm. She is a Civil War expert. She's traveled the world going to different regions.
Manassas, Virginia, Atlanta, Georgia.
More recent Civil Wars. The more recent Civil Wars. And she gives the background. The first few chapters are all about all these other countries' civil wars and how they started and what red flags we need to maybe think about in this country.
And that's the interesting part is that she took her work and flipped it on the United States. Mm-hmm. And anyway, it was quite disturbing
I'm not sure if I heard an interview with Barbara F. Walter. I might have, but I feel like this was quite familiar ground to me, this argument that the U.S. is in a sort of pre-Civil War moment. I felt like a lot of my favorite podcasts, like 538, which is a politics podcast that looks at statistics and polling, On the Media, a really great NPR podcast that looks at social media as well as legacy media. So she was working with a lot of statistics and arguments that I was familiar with. It was nice to have them all gathered in a single book, though. So I found that really interesting.
One of the first things she mentions is the hyper-partisanship that we have in America right now, the division between groups. And how
do we see any of that, Steve? I mean, should we wear a mask or not?
We will find out when the school board has their meeting and when the court cases are cleared up. Because yeah, there's some big issues and some reasonably small issues like wearing masks that are divisive right now.
Small, Steve. We should probably have a protest out in front of that school.
Yeah, it's been quite a week for my school for sure. We've got a lot of issues that certain people of certain perspectives think we're doing it right, and other people think that we're doing it wrong, and we don't know the right answers.
Well, they do, Steve, and thank goodness they can tell us what to do.
And that's where the danger of this divisiveness comes in and becomes something that could become as huge as a civil war.
Okay. Well, in fact, that is why I suggested this book. When it first came out, it certainly is. I mean, the question is it a provocateur? Yeah, I'm going to put together a set of arguments. And, is it reasonable that this could take place? Or is this just something that we're destined for? And there's the part of the book that gets kind of interesting. This is the nuances that you kind of run through.
Some of the things that I took from this are the imperceptibility of how things get to the level of a civil war, how the small little changes lead there. And she gives all of these anecdotes about different countries that she traveled to and saw and spoke to these people on how this all happened, going all the way back to, not a civil war, but World War II, where the people of Germany didn't know that something terrible was happening until suddenly it was upon them.
To me, the interesting new metric, so because a lot of this was quite familiar ground. Like if you're a news person, you're quite familiar with the conflicts that she's covering.
People don't watch the news. They're fake.
Exactly, right? But I thought the polity score, that was something I wasn't familiar with. I'm not sure if you were, this notion of scoring countries between autocracy and democracy and how there's this sort of sweet spot or very dark spot, where if a country is not quite a democracy, although it might be called one, or a country is not quite a dictatorship, although countries in transition are the ones who are really in danger of civil war. So yeah, so that was a metric that I actually hadn't heard before that I found quite interesting. And, just on like a polling level, we now live in a, like in the US, more people are willing to marry across religion or race than across political party.
Okay?
So that's a really interesting sort of sociological statistic that kind of supports that notion of hyperpartisanship on a personal level that I find.
We have some demographic changes, and they happen. There used to be more conservative people in the Democratic Party and more liberal people in the Republican Party. It may have been where you lived determined where your party was.
Mm-hmm.
Those people died. And so the parties have become, at least in the United States, become more divisive. And then you've got this whole group of in-betweeners that are kind of like, neither group is representing what I want.
And back to the geography of it for a second, our civil war here in the United States was certainly geographic, North and South, and
slaveholding state and non-slaveholding state.
Okay. And now the way that we are reading this book and thinking about who we are in the division might be not geographic. There might be a more local feeling to it, like Pam said, within families even.
I don't know how this ultimately would play out. I mean, that she kind of explores that a little bit later on, but it just seems very, like, if you're in an urban area, you have a very diverse population.
Mm-hmm.
You start moving out to Iowa and Nebraska and, I don't know, Idaho, Montana, certainly it gets much more homogeneous as far as, and it just seems that what California wants or what New York wants or what an urban area wants could be very different from what a rural area. They're like, I don't see what the issue is because they're not around a lot more of it.
And back to that word perspective for a second. The idea of you know only what you know. You don't know the rest of the story. And putting together a book like this and maybe not having all of the data, and maybe it's impossible to know everything. But
didn't she came to a conclusion on that. They have all these variables they're looking at. It was only a couple of them that really made the difference between likely civil war versus non-civil war. There was only a couple of them that were like, these are the ones that matter.
Yeah, that was one of the takeaways that I really appreciated actually from the early part of the book, was this notion that there's actually not that much of a correlation between economic inequity and civil war, where there's a much higher correlation with the polity score in terms of where your government is. And that goes against my intuition, because I feel like, you know, when we think about periods of extreme strife, we do think about times of economic instability. But I was actually quite persuaded by her arguments, by her numbers on that matter. So that was a real takeaway for me.
And an easy way to think about that is who stormed the Capitol.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so there were CEOs, senior military officials. These are educated people.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, people that we may think have more resources available to them, or at least more skills or more thought on how to do these, along with a whole group of just rank and file everyday Joes.
Mm-hmm.
And these are not the most educated, the most thoughtful people. They haven't been trained to think on that level, but they created a coalition.
Mm-hmm. And this idea that she points out over and over again in the book, that civil wars really start when there's a loss of hope, when a group believes that their power is being taken away and they are willing to fight to keep that power.
Princess Leia.
I thought about Star Wars a lot in this. The idea of the rebels deciding that this was their only course was to fight this big bad imperial, you know, existence. And we've read the other side of that, where the Imperials aren't thinking in terms of evil. They are just doing what they think is the right thing.
Well, and there seems to be part of the disconnect is how information is being delivered to our population.
Mm-hmm.
And listen, I am not suggesting that somehow we should limit how information gets delivered. But, you know, if you've got, I mean, use CNN and Fox as our example, they have two very different voices on news. Whoever's in power, one of them says is the devil, the other one is a saint.
Mm-hmm.
They can do no wrong, and how dare you suggest that they are. But the reality of it is we've got a whole group of people who are ignoring all of them and going to even more alternative.
Even more voices. Extreme. The extremes, yeah. On both sides, for sure.
And what we're seeing, like with a podcast like Joe Rogan, who is doing long form conversation, which, you know, is Joe Rogan. I mean, he seems like an inquisitive guy. If you go back in time, Mike Wallace used to do those interviews with all the intellectuals. You know, he'd sit there and smoke cigarettes in black and white, and they would talk things out. And these were people, you know, from, you know, all sorts of backgrounds.
Mm-hmm.
we're not, that seems to be one where many, some people are getting their news. Mm-hmm. Other people are getting their news through Facebook feeds,
yeah,
or through algorithms, through services like Google. And if it feeds you what you like, it's going to become more and more and more extreme.
The echo chamber.
And you don't need, I mean, from my knowledge, you don't need 100% agreement, 50% agreement. You need to get about 10% agreement, and you can sway pretty much anything you want.
Mm-hmm.
And so if through social media, you can target who is likely to be have an impression on this, it's not going to be any of us.
Right.
So I really like that analysis, Chip, but I want to go back to something Steve said about loss of hope. So this was one of her central notions, is that when you get into this sweet spot or this dark spot with the Polity score, then there has to be some sort of factor and something has to happen that causes people to lose hope. So now in chapter 3, she talked a bit about the climate crisis and about how there would be a lot of climate migrants. And this is another real threat, a vulnerability, right? That countries who are going to have fewer climate migrants are going to face. But I actually thought, like, I would like to dig a little bit deeper into that loss of hope. Because of course, and again, this is such a personal, but like as someone who studies utopia, dystopia, and apocalyptic literature, that's what that literature is all based on, mm-hmm. is, you know, how are people motivated and how does hope function? And so I was super curious what you guys thought of chapter 7, that chapter where she says, you wake up in 2028 and here's mm-hmm. what happens. Now, as you guys were reading that apocalyptic vision of what the US in civil war would look like, were you guys persuaded by that? Were you, what did you think of that section? I was just very curious.
I was definitely persuaded by the narrative nature of how she laid out what her vision of what could be as a result of the small things that are happening now. The 2028, just all of the possibilities of who's the president and what kind of power the president has versus the Congress and the possibilities of all of the extremists on both sides being in control in terms of violence and what they could do. I thought that that narrative was very, very interesting.
Well, I've seen the trailer for Doctor Strange and the Multiverse of Madness.
I have not, so don't tell me about it.
So all I can say is there's lots of alternatives, and that would just be one of many.
But she lays out a path that is very plausible here.
But the hope of this comes through some education. I mean, it seems that many people don't know how civics work.
And yeah, she mentions that.
And so, you know, when the president is not a king, it's not what they want. And when the majority says, this is what I want, that doesn't mean that they get to trample everybody's civil rights.
And I really hung my hat on that through the Trump presidency. The idea of the Constitution, the idea of who we are as a nation and the checks and balances built into the system, for me, I think they are pretty brilliant and they keep such things from happening.
They are, but they do allow things to slip away. Mm-hmm. And part of it is that the president can go to war without announcing it's a war. And all of a sudden we are doing all sorts of things that may or may not get called out by the checks and balances, which is Congress.
And that has been an issue for a good decade now.
And that's not a Trump issue. And that's not an Obama issue. This is a pattern issue. Yeah. No one said that how everything is set up is perfect, but understanding how it works gives you the power to use it,
mm-hmm.
and to also gives you comfort on what it may not be able to do.
One of the ideas that she puts forward, and quite persuasively, I think, is that majoritarian governments that really only have two, where you win the whole thing versus parliamentary systems, you know, so even if the popular vote might go one way, the electoral vote goes another, well, then that's the person who's the president. Compared to parliamentary systems around the world, are much more at risk of civil war. Like, I bought that, but mm-hmm. I had a really interesting experience as a Canadian reading this book in 2022. The book was just published, but now it's February 2022. And Canada, which she cites many times as a country that's got it under control, you know, doesn't have it under control right now. And so well,
the truckers certainly help out.
They made their voice heard for sure.
But this is one of the things that's so fascinating about a book like this, where her argument is, look, if you study what happens globally, you run the numbers, you can make really good predictions. And she made the prediction that whatever, her four or five sweet countries, including Canada, my very own sweet country, they're fine. But we have to worry about the US. And then as this book is in, like, it's only been out for what, 2 months, mm-hmm. that becomes less and less accurate mm-hmm. because Canada is facing substantial civil unrest right now, which is very upsetting. And Canada has a parliamentarian system. It has a much more representative democracy. It's at a 10 in the democracy scale. It hasn't been identified as someone with this scary polity score. And yet it's facing this. I'm not saying Canada's on the brink of a civil war, but she didn't in any way anticipate what has happened over the past, whatever, 20 or 22 days.
Mm-hmm. Well, I that is my critique of this book, is that this is incredibly insightful. I think she put a really nice argument together. But this is not a complete argument. This is part of looking at how societies get set up. And this doesn't necessarily mean it has to come true. This is, if you were a person and you were in on a committee, you were making military decisions, you're making government decisions on how to work with, say, another government, or you're making business decisions on whether you should be in a certain area or not, this could be incredibly useful. Like, resources are going to go to help a group. But, you know, that doesn't mean that this has to be true. And you know, she talks a little bit about that, but I don't necessarily think the model, as wonderful as it is, means that this is the complete answer on this. This is just one way to consider a lot of information on a lot of unknowns.
Back to that word perspective. She has a perspective from her study that is still incomplete. Even though she is the expert in civil wars, she's still got an incomplete perspective. We all do. That's how it works.
And of course, I felt like one perspective she didn't bring in at all was literature. Hmm. And I think that literature is one of the ways that people try to create these really nuanced perspectives, looking at the exact issues that she's talking about, which, again, is not her job as a political scientist to bring in literature. But I felt that gap. I felt that she did try to do a little storytelling when she set out the apocalyptic vision. But in terms of, like, you know, there are a lot of people who are creating really powerful narratives on this topic. And so I really want to know what you guys thought about her three sort of big solutions in the final chapter. She says, like, how could we avoid a civil war, which is her subtitle of the book. And she notes three strategies: electoral reform, better government programs so that people feel like they actually are being taken care of, they are safe. And then the third is regulating social media, which she sees as the most powerful way to move past this current moment. What do you guys think of that?
Well, let's talk about social media for a moment, because that seems to be ripe for abuse. Mm-hmm. Okay, so it could be abuse internal. It could be external mm-hmm. abuse. Because think of how, if I am an external country and I want to have an impact on the United States, that you could create, it's propaganda. Mm-hmm. I mean, you could create a propaganda system that you don't have to reach everybody. You have to reach certain people.
Right.
And you can create all sorts of challenges there.
And we have so much evidence that that has been happening, and that those influences from outside of our country might be sparking some of this divisiveness.
And in fact, that it would be designed mm-hmm. specifically for that challenge. Don't worry, the United States is doing it elsewhere too. Hmm. So we know how to use these tools too. And think about how China addresses their social media? I mean, can Google go anywhere?
No.
Okay. So is that a better system?
Is it?
I don't know.
I don't know.
Ask the people from Hong Kong if it's a better system.
Right.
They seem to be fighting pretty hard to not have that.
Right.
What do you do? Right now, the big tech companies aren't necessarily addressing it that well.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, Facebook is probably the most powerful of the social network or their companies that they own.
Mm-hmm.
And they're having a difficult time addressing it, even if they had interest in doing it, because the whistleblower keeps saying that it's not really of interest.
And that was all of chapter 5, where she does mark the idea of the accelerant that is this social media.
Yeah. So, I mean, I keep looking at Steve because he's right here, but I mean to look at you, Pam. I mean, social media certainly seems to be designed to take you to the place. You are determining the answer before you get there. You're just looking for supporting material.
Right. So I'm just going to say, for me, reading her three big ideas. So I think electoral reform, lovely idea, never going to happen. There's no way you can get the people in power to give it up, which is what you have to do in order to really create electoral reform.
If there was, if you could gerrymander something.
She does mention gerrymandering. She does mention that.
That sliver in North Carolina that goes up this. It's a long sliver.
Exactly. So, but I guess I don't see that. When I think electoral reform, I don't think, yes, I am filled with hope. I think, whatever, interesting idea, never going to happen, personally. Now, in terms of creating like a utopian world where people aren't dissatisfied, you know, these better government programs, I don't know. I'm also not very hopeful. Now, regulating social media is a really interesting idea. And I was kind of fascinated that I think it was in 2021, the word deplatforming was one of those like words of the year, which is such a great word. It reminds me of defenestration, like a word that you don't really think about, but you know. And so this, and she says this in the book, that, you know, deplatforming Donald Trump really had a huge impact right away.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Yes, it did.
Well, well, let me back up, because that was really important. But let's go back to the Obama administration, where they controlled their press releases. As in, if you wanted to do it, you had to go through their office.
Mm-hmm.
Trump just basically said, we're going to go directly to the population.
Mm-hmm.
And before that, you know, it was different. Probably Obama's election was probably the most effective use of social media.
Mm-hmm.
So I think, I think that's a really important point. And I do think that that was one of the things that was so different about the Trump presidency, was that he, as a single individual, was communicating directly with the people instead of going through, I would say, like the bureaucratic process for press releases that pretty much every American president and most world leaders have always used, like vetting their materials before sending them directly out to people. But so anyway, I think the social media regulation is really, really tough. And I mean, I'm not saying it couldn't be regulated. She's suggesting it should be regulated, just like we should have an FDA for social media, basically, right? And I think that's a really tough argument to make. So I'm not saying it shouldn't be pursued in some ways, but I guess I'm personally thinking, and this is such a personal perspective, but I guess I believe in education over regulation. I think it's more it's more doable. And that's an optimistic notion, right? But that when you actually get kids in a classroom and you provide them with really interesting and nuanced curriculum, you can actually teaching civics, you know, that notion. I can't remember what the percentage, but the percentage who can name the three branches of American government is really low. That's really sad. So I think we do need to do a lot of reform in our education system, K through PhD.
Well, and that was one of the, right. So I'm going to agree with you, but also show how it can be that's not necessarily the independent way. So in North Carolina, which I found in their education system, K through 12 system, that was vastly different than Illinois' K through 12 system, is they spent a lot of time teaching us how the government works. we went to DC. I mean, I probably went 3 or 4 times when I was in school. I knew the 3 levels of government. I knew how the state government worked. Okay. But we also got a history of North Carolina that was not necessarily true history.
Hmm.
I mean, think about it. It was written by a group of people. And, you know, we discussed Wilmington's Lie. That wasn't part of it.
Right.
It was more sympathetic to the South during the Civil War. There was a whole bunch of those parts. So there's the point, is that there's never a perfect answer. And when I moved up here and I worked with some of the people I knew, I was really shocked that they didn't understand to the depth. Mm-hmm. I understood. I'm not saying that I'm not blind to something.
Sure.
But my point is that I think I had a pretty good grasp over it. And did that come from education or me having more of an interest in it? But I can tell you that I feel more comfortable understanding how it works than many people, I would say, are my peers.
And she talks about civics in this book. She talks about how us studying this and thinking about these ideas instead of being ignorant to it would be better for us.
So how does Springfield work here in Illinois?
Mm-hmm.
Well, Springfield is a capital, but many of the offices are held in Chicago.
Right.
So Springfield is the capital. It's not down there. Would it make a difference if it was down there
mm-hmm.
versus up here? And the argument also could be, well, the population's up here. So mm-hmm. should it be where the population is? So these are really interesting questions. And then what do you do with the needs of the rural areas versus some of the urban areas?
Because they're different. The needs are different for different groups of people.
Correct.
Yeah.
Correct. And certainly...
The equity and equality are not the same thing. We need to find that equity. Yeah,
I do think that there is another hope that may have been missed a little bit here is the millennials are a large voting bloc.
Mm-hmm.
And this also could be, at least in the United States, the handover, because, you know, I'm Gen X, and we're just
angry. We're always forgotten. Yeah.
Yeah. If they could just forget.
Oh, it's your 16th birthday? Oh, sorry.
That's right. Exactly. Jake, at least Jake will remember.
Jake remembered.
16 candles for the reference for everyone. It's a movie. It's by John Hughes. But anyway, millennials are very collaborative. They work well in teams. They're different from boomers.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe this is the handoff. This could be the power change. There could be a lot of, and that could be part of this uneasiness that we're experiencing right now. Mm-hmm. Like, how could you do things differently from our generation?
Mm-hmm. That loss of power, that's her central idea of how civil wars start, is a group feels like their power is going away to a different group. Uh-huh.
And the other thing that I want to bring up is that, you know, I've read a number of books and with a lot of different theories, but, you know, there are different, you know, there are different groups of people in the United States. The Appalachian area is different than Deep South, is mm-hmm. different from the North. They view things differently. And so recognizing that what is good in Southern Ohio may be different than what's good in Northern Ohio,
mm-hmm.
because it's the difference in many ways from the North and the South and how they value and look at things. And looking at things differently doesn't mean that they're wrong. We can have different end goals, but we can live with each other.
And we can work together, even though our goals might be different. It's when they are vastly different and opposing goals that we have a real problem.
Yeah, there's a lot of discomfort going on right here. We have a large group of people. I think people really misunderstand that market-based economies require growing populations, and either you're going to make babies or you're going to import those babies.
Mm.
And we need those people. And the United States is still an area that the world seeks out. And in many ways, if you would go and visit more areas, maybe you would be more understanding of what the blessings that you have. It's a very religious word there, but I mean, it is what you have available here is many times other parts of the world really struggle with.
Mm-hmm. I took that away from this for sure, is the author has this perspective because of her travels. I need to travel more to get a better perspective of this country and the rest of the world.
You know, the beaches of Cancun.
I've never been.
You know, those cold drinks are probably could help.
I've heard great things. Pam, did you have another point?
I actually really like your point, Chip, about millennials and about the way that they actually see the world quite differently from how we do. And I sit here today agreeing with most of the premises of her argument, but filled with a little bit more hope than perhaps is visible in this text. And I actually think that the climate crisis does bring people together across lines. And we have, you know, recent polling suggests that, you know, 10 years ago, there was a real divide, a bipartisan divide about how much people were focused on the climate crisis. And that divide has decreased substantially. So now across parties, people are really thinking about the climate crisis. And the fact that we've had extreme weather events in every part of the country. And because Chip, I think you're right about the importance of geography too. The events are different.
Snowstorms here.
But mm-hmm. Right, exactly. The events are different, but they're still extreme and they're still extremely disruptive. And so having something to work on together that is going to require not only going across the bipartisan divide in the US, but really global solutions, I actually see that with a bit of hope, which might be naive on my part, but that's my perspective.
As I was walking through the forest preserve in 70 degree weather just last weekend, I was really contemplating the real challenges of perfect weather.
Mm-hmm.
And compared to, say, up here.
But back to your goal setting. If we have a singular goal, like the climate crisis, if we all agree that that is a goal that we need to solve, maybe our different paths to solving it will actually bring us together as opposed to opposition to that goal.
And part of the other challenge I'm going to add to this is, you know, think of like recent events, how they could immediately change every part of this.
Mm-hmm.
So think about, we've got a Russia saber-rattling outside Ukraine.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that could immediately change on how anything gets addressed, even how the United States views itself.
Mm-hmm.
So as much as divides end up happening and stuff like that, that could just be an ebb and flow of nature, of how societies work. We don't have perfect information.
Correct. On this.
I don't want to undercut an expert in the expertise that she has spent a lifetime accumulating to be able to advise. But I ultimately think that there's something else missing in here.
Mm-hmm.
So while this is certainly, hey, a feather that's part of a decision, this is can't be the only feathers.
So Pam, would you suggest this book to people who are interested in civics and history and all of the other things that she brings up here?
I think if you haven't been paying a lot of attention to the news, this is probably a really, really great primer on issues of conflict. If you have, it'll be very familiar ground.
I think the expertise really brings something to it that I, watching the news, get my little tiny bit of information, but she has the study and the statistics to back up her ideas here. What do you think, Chip?
We need to pray more.
Eat, pray, love. That's our next book.
I'm glad I read this. This was a book that certainly was very timely. It came out, it caught my eye. Certainly it's a provocateur. Once again, you have to ask yourself, is it something that is true or if it's something that is of its time?
Hmm.
But you know what? I enjoyed it. I do recommend that if you want to be a timely person at that dinner party, understanding some of the modern arguments and some of the tools being used, this is a good place to go.
I would love to go to a dinner party. Thank you for
inviting. I was thinking the exact same thing. I'm like, yes, my weekly dinner parties.
Yes. Well, yes. It's going to be
a soiree
at the Clampets with a fancy eating table.
with the sticks to pick up the pots to move on the fancy table.
On the billiards table.
All right, now I know what you're talking about. For the first time in an hour, that's the first time I know what you're talking about. Beverly Hillbillies.
Beverly Hillbillies. Everything goes back to basically the 1960s and sitcoms. It's the premise, a man finds oil, moves his family to Beverly Hillbillies, and is a man or a family out of water.
I suggest that many of our listeners would enjoy this book. However, I take that with a grain of salt because I am a person that when I read a book, I get very emotionally attached to it. And I was very emotionally attached to this book while I was reading it. It made for a very dark week for me. So I put that asterisk on my suggestion that maybe you would like this book.
Extra vitamin D and long walk.
I took all the vitamin D and I read this book and it was still a dark week, sir. That's How Civil Wars Start and How to Stop Them by Barbara F. Walter.
Scroll with it.
Brings us to our scroll with it. We've been talking a lot about statistics and the idea of the future, and you found something interesting this week.
I did. You know, when we said, Chip, did you watch something? I did watch something. And in fact, if you are a person who likes to watch talks, there are plenty of professors, plenty of intellectuals that have good materials, and you can put it however you want to describe it. This is a professor at the University of South Florida, Eric Winsberg. He has put out a video basically talking a little bit about how we use models and some of the shortcomings on how we use it for predicting and predictive purposes. And one of the challenges he brings up when using models, I use models every day for my clients. We use models, we use them for their predictive ability. It is there to help guide us on looking at unclear futures. Mm-hmm. It is not everything that we would use. We still live our lives. We still have to make decisions based on this. But what it does is it hopefully will make a little more comfortable with the decisions that we make.
Okay.
He's particularly critiquing our modelings. When we say that we are following the science, what are we really saying when we're using that? And what is being left out? And what he is arguing that one of the shortcomings that we use when we're using COVID data initially was one, we didn't necessarily have great data. Mm-hmm. But the other part is many times they were running those models based on the person running those models. Like that is the not the average person, the median person, that was the person that was the every person.
That perspective, right back to that word perspective. You are making this model, you are basing it on your knowledge. You can't do it any other way.
And I think that over time, we will find our data was not very good. Our models were not very good. That doesn't mean that you should damn the leaders who had to make decisions based on it. It's just what it was at the time. But we are going to, and he said this was one of the most important models, if not the most important model that we have used. And we're going to start using more models to help predict stuff. And some of the shortcomings that we were running into is that we didn't add other factors, other types of people that could have been impacted. So the trucker, the person who is a worker that requires not just schools to be the learning place, but also the place that the child can go to while they work and stuff like that. And that this was a weakness of in something that we really need to consider as we start using more and more predictive models. We can't just look at one group of people and say, follow the science, because we could be abusing what that term really means. Now, that doesn't mean that they're not useful. That doesn't mean that they were not useful at that time. But we're at a point now where we have enough time that an intellectual like Eric can come in and he can kind of help us think about the use of those tools and not to abuse them, not to overstate what they really are trying to help with. So anyway, I found this incredibly useful. If you are a person who has the capability of understanding the arguments, that he is making. I would highly suggest it. And if you're a person who may pick up some of it, this would be something that would be very interesting. This is a very thought-provoking piece. Steve, you know what? There is something for the everyman out there.
Uh-huh.
And this is the important part because, you know, Ball State, they have a scholarship for the most average student
out there. For the C students. Yes, sir. Yes.
And you know what? So not everyone can be an A student.
That's right.
So should we bless David Letterman?
Okay. Let me start with the premise that I admire a lot of people that have done a lot of great things. And I admire a lot of people that do silly entertainment things. David Letterman is one of those men that I admire his ability to be a part of an interview, whether he's being interviewed or conducting the interview. He is entertaining in any situation.
Steve, without David Letterman, how would we know what watermelons look like when they fall from long distances?
Gallagher would have shown us the inside of a watermelon. David Letterman, yes, you're right. The Ball State scholarship for C students that I was in the running for and did not get. David Letterman.
You weren't C enough, Steve.
I wasn't average enough to get that scholarship. But yes, David Letterman is one of those men that I really, truly admire. And his level of comedy, I aspire to being as thought-provoking and thoughtful and kind and cruel and all of the other things that David Letterman is.
There would be an interesting book where you would take, say, George Carlin, Steve Martin, David Letterman, compare American type of humor of that time. And you could even go like the National Lampoon writers and stuff like that.
Sure.
Okay. That was a very different view of comedy versus the British, where you start looking at John Cleese and all of there. Because they both were used of the time. Maybe current generations don't understand it as well as that, but it certainly was a unique, there was a uniqueness. David Letterman played a television host. The audience was there to participate in it. And David was doing stupid stuff as if it was amazing stuff. With, you know, just a touch of brilliance in there.
Yeah. I would like to get your sabbatical on track so that you can write that monogram.
Oh, there we go.
Because Pam's here, so I'm using sabbatical and monogram. That's the only reason those words came into my head.
Word writing, assuming that I understood the English language, Steve.
So from my perspective, I want you to know David Letterman has a new archive of all of his work on YouTube. Go to youtube.com/Letterman and just enjoy, bask in the genius that is that one guy and his performance.
Be the Paul Schaefer, man.
I love Paul Schaefer, too. Am, are you a fan of David Letterman?
Insofar as I'm not a big TV watcher, so I probably haven't seen as much as I should have.
You watch more TV than Chip.
You can take a suit and you can jump against a wall and you can stick to it.
Steve. I love that stuff. Love it. I love all this stuff. I think we have enough information to survive another week. What do you think, Chip?
Only if we can have a top 10 list, Steve, and come back next week.
Come back next week. That's your homework for next week. Bring your top 10 list. We want to hear from you. What do you think, Pam?
Sure. Only if I can come back next month.
There you go.
From the home office in Peoria, Illinois.
We would love to hear from you. What's your top 10? How are you feeling? Where are you at with the study of the Civil War and the possibilities of the future? Give us a call or a text. Our phone number is 805-410-4TMS. Our website is toomuchscrolling.com. Our email is toomuchscrolling@gmail.com. We're on Twitter and Instagram and Facebook, all of the social medias. Did you notice that? Spotify, Apple Podcasts, and YouTube. And you can always ask your smart speaker to play the latest episode of Too Much Scrolling. I want to thank you again for listening to Too Much Scrolling. I'm Steve Fodor.
I'm Chip Hessenblood.
And I'm Pam Bedard.
We'll see you in the future.